WrestleSpective Radio is not affiliated with World Wrestling Entertainment, TNA Wrestling, Ring of Honor Wrestling, or any other sports entertainment entity or personality.
You're listening to WrestleSpective Radio. Learn to love it.
Welcome to WrestleSpective. I'm Jason Mann. Before we begin, I want to tell you about my sponsor, RudoReels.com. It is a great place to get DVDs and downloads of professional wrestling from the United States, Mexico, Japan, pretty much anywhere in which they have professional wrestling. So check it out, RudoReels.com. And I'd like to welcome today my guest. He is Will Pruitt of ProWrestling.net. Will, welcome back to the show.
Great to be here. I'm pretty excited to discuss this match, one of the formative ones in my kind of adolescence. I'll go with adolescence here.
Okay. All right. Good. I was almost 21 at this point, so you're making me feel a little old by talking about that. This is the main event of Backlash 2000, Triple H defending the WWE Championship against The Rock. And this is a match in which many people felt should have been the main event of WrestleMania, but it was delayed a month. And sort of an interesting strategy by WWE, and one that paid off definitely commercially, and I think as well in the story that was told.
Yeah, it definitely paid off commercially. I think we look back on it now, and WrestleMania 2000 appears as this kind of cluster mess of Mick Foley retired, and he said he's leaving forever. 3 weeks later, he's back, and Big Show Big Show really out of shape, and a WrestleMania main event. And we look back now and we say, why didn't they just book the one-on-one match? Why didn't they just go with that? But like you said, commercially and even critically, I feel like they had to have this match, and one big element of this match I don't think was ready to happen at WrestleMania 2000, and that was Steve Austin.
Right. Steve Austin is in the corner of The Rock, at least in theory is going to be, although there's some developments in there that we'll get to when we talk about how this match was put together. But, you're right. I think on a historical level, as far as looking back at WrestleMania 2000, it made WrestleMania 2000 a weaker show, definitely. But it did. I think how it helped this show and just how it kind of fed into that story of waiting a month. I just think that you got to the point in 2000 and in years before and years since where the inevitability of the good guy coming out of WrestleMania as the champion was such. Getting to the point of where it was an overdone thing, where I think this being the exception, I think was a nice surprise, and it played well into the storytelling that they went into in the spring and into the summer.
Yeah, it took 16 years for them to get to a good guy coming out of WrestleMania or a bad guy coming out of WrestleMania, on top.
Right, exactly.
It took so long to get there that it's like WWE had to do this at some point. Recently, we're recording this in August 2012. I forgot what month it was for a second. That's right. We're recording this in August 2012, and John Cena recently cashed in the Money in the Bank and did not win the WWE Championship with it, and it was like eventually someone had to not win the championship with Money in the Bank. It became the same thing at WrestleMania. It was this foregone conclusion that the good guy had to win at Mania. And it was nice to see WWE not do that for once. Just looking back at the overall arc of the story, it was fun to see WWE not have that good guy win, but to leave people wanting more. And business-wise, it worked.
Yeah, it was the second biggest pay-per-view of 2000 to WrestleMania. It beat, SummerSlam. It beat Rumble, which had the great, Mick Foley Triple H story. It even beat Unforgiven that year, which was big because that was Steve Austin's return. So yeah, that's a pretty incredible thing to have happen. You know, when we're really in an era now where the big shows are the ones people pay attention to, the WrestleMania by far the biggest, but also SummerSlam and Royal Rumble and sometimes Survivor Series, and everything else is pretty much like low, low, low. Even if it has like a big, you know, match like a John Cena versus Brock Lesnar, for instance, at Backlash, didn't do anything, you know, didn't attract nearly the attention that something like this did.
Yeah, I mean, we look at, you know, to bring up buys again, this match, it was the continuation of an ongoing feud. It wasn't a special attraction match per se. It was, well, we have Rock and Triple H happening already. Their next pay-per-view match is at Backlash. It wasn't the special attraction that, like, Cena versus Lesnar was earlier this year. And
right.
Cena versus Lesnar did, around a third of the buys that WrestleMania did. It didn't get up to that level the way that Backlash really got up to the WrestleMania level here in the year 2000.
Exactly. So, yeah, I mean, basically the thrust of it is that at WrestleMania 2000, there's a McMahon in every corner. It's the four-way match, which is elimination. So Big Show is eliminated early. Foley is eliminated midway through. Then Triple H and Rock have a long match battle. Vince is in Rock's corner, and the reason he's in Rock's corner is because he hates Triple H because Triple H drugged up and, well, he's drugging up and marrying Stephanie. Turns out that Stephanie's in the ruse, so Vince is hating Triple H because of that. And Stephanie, in fact, turned on Vince in their Armageddon 99 match. Then Linda's in Foley's corner, Shane's in Big Show's corner, and Stephanie, of course, in Triple H's corner. The end of the match is Vince turning on The Rock and helping Triple H with the idea is that he's reuniting the family back together, everyone except for Linda. But he sort of gets both Stephanie and Shane on board with this. It's sort of like they're sort of like a new big stable, with DX also being heels and being on Triple H's side. So you kind of have that sort of a little bit of a corporation revamp, but that kind of thing. So here the odds are stacked against The Rock. He gets the rematch, but he has to deal with Vince and Steph being in Triple H's corner. He has to deal with Shane being the special referee, but Linda brings in Steve Austin, who hadn't been on TV since Survivor Series 99 because he had neck surgery.
I thought he got hit by a car.
He did, and he got neck surgery because he got hit by a car.
Oh, okay. I just thought he was still recovering from the car accident.
Maybe. So, yeah, they wrote him off at Survivor Series 99 because he was hit by a car. In reality, of course, he had big neck problems and had that surgery that put him out for a year. So Austin's in The Rock's corner, but they also play into the fact that The Rock and Austin have never really been on the same side in particular, and that Austin may, in fact, not be that enthusiastic about being behind The Rock, even though, of course, he is no friend to the McMahons and Triple H.
Yeah, they played into the, you know, kind of will he, won't he thing, even just throughout the match. Will Austin show up? Is he here? And The Rock before guaranteed that Austin would show up. And I have to ask you, is a guarantee stronger than a guarantee? And why did everyone say guarantee in the year 2000?
I feel like, yes, it is stronger. And I feel like that, you know, superfluous profanity was just something that we expected in the Attitude Era. It's just like if you just made a guarantee, it didn't have the sort of legal weight that a guarantee did.
I wonder if that was written into any contracts in the period. Like, when you signed the contract for your match, it was like, and we guarantee
exactly
that you will have this official. Right. Oh, well, as long as that damn's in there, I'm totally down to sign it. If right. that wasn't there, you'd be hearing from my lawyers.
Exactly.
And the McMahon-Helmsley faction was really interesting because when Triple H married Stephanie, he was kind of on this heel run with DX, and it wasn't going so well. Like, DX, it was like Road Dogg, Billy Gunn, and X-Pac, and Tori, inexplicably. And they all kind of turned heel, and it was this odd just collection of guys. You know, it was like those guys that used to be cool in high school, and now they're just the bullies that hang out, and I don't know. It was an odd conglomeration of people. But when you added Stephanie McMahon to it, and when you gave them actual power and turned them into the fac-gime, as Edge and Christian like to call them,
yeah,
it worked. Like, it really worked well. And, of course, they got to party on the DX Express.
Which is a great place to party, apparently.
Yeah, I've heard that. The DX Express is a mighty nice bus until the last SmackDown before the show we're talking about.
Right, where Austin is... Rock says Austin is there. The bad guys all keep looking for Austin in the different corners, the bowels of the arena. And then finally, we have a reveal on the video screen in which Austin has some sort of large crane that is able to destroy the DX Express.
Yeah, it's hoisting a large beam.
Yes.
And it had a label on it that said Austin Deconstruction.
Yes.
And then he basically dropped it on the DX Express. This moment was immortalized in video game form in the SmackDown 2 game for the PlayStation. And I remember this because, you know, when I was 12 or 13 and playing that game incessantly, I would just play through the career mode, and every year when you got to Backlash that year, the main event in the career mode was Triple H versus The Rock with Steve Austin and Shane McMahon as special referees. And every year you had to watch the clip of Steve Austin, digital Steve Austin, dropping the digital beam on the digital DX Express.
Wow.
Yeah, I think I saw that 10 times at least.
Memorable for you. Yeah, you definitely invested far more learning the particulars of that event than I did. So so kudos to you.
It was part of my pre-match watching. It's the most memorable angle, like, surrounding this match, or one of the more memorable of this year in wrestling for me. So it just kind of...
Okay. Yeah, I had no memory of that whatsoever until I watched the video package and had it described. So it's funny how, because I was watching pretty intently in this time, it's just funny how, like, certain things will stick with you. And obviously the video game helped you, but still, you know, the particulars of things that, you know, the particular memorable angles, no matter how important they were at the time, some stick with you and some don't.
And I think some of it has to do with age, too. You said you were 21 at the time. Yeah. I was 12 at the time.
Right.
It was like I was, you know, at my probably at my most wrestling obsessed, although I think I spend more time on wrestling now. But, you know, at my most, like, devoting as much brain power and everything as I could to it.
Yeah.
And this was Steve Austin, this big star, this anti-hero coming back. So his first appearance in... what, 6 months-ish?
Yeah.
It stuck with me quite a bit.
Sure. Also, The Rock had to beat, I believe it was Big Boss Man and Bull Buchanan in a handicap cage match. So, to get this title shot. So, good for him. He kind of owned the Boss Man because he beat the Boss Man in 4 seconds at Survivor Series 98.
That's true.
That was a ruse, but still.
Rock 0-2 or 2-0 against Big Boss Man.
At least, yeah.
Yeah, I doubt Big Boss Man ever beat The Rock.
But The Rock would get beaten by a lot of guys, though. I mean, it would surprise me, too, but, it was like Boss Man did beat, or Rock, you know, lost, like, to Mark Henry and lost to, you know, a bunch of people when he was very popular.
True. That's one of the interesting things about The Rock, and I think as we get into the promotion of this match, one of the interesting things. The Rock was, in a way, you could say he was co-first babyface, but in a way, too, he was almost the second babyface going into this match because Austin was so popular, and the Austin appearance was so heavily teased, and so, it was guaranteed that Austin was going to show up.
Sure.
Even as the match begun, the first thing that happened was a "We Want Austin" chant started in the crowd.
Yeah.
So,
indeed. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just found it interesting. And the big go, you know, kind of the go home, the final image was Austin getting the best of the McMahon Helmsley regime, not The Rock getting the best of them.
Yeah. Although I felt like at this point was when The Rock was kind of emerging from Austin's shadow. It's interesting that you see it that way, and I don't think you're wrong, but at least this time it was kind of like, you know, The Rock was sort of emerging. I mean, definitely as the 1A guy, but I mean, he obviously just with Austin's absence, I felt like Rock was just was carrying it on his own even without Austin being there. I mean, obviously Austin had no part of WrestleMania or Rumble through WrestleMania like you know normally you would. So that was kind of The Rock's time to shine and afterward as well. But you're right, when they were side by side, it was still Austin, you know, was clearly the number one. I don't think that really changed until maybe 2002.
Yeah, when Austin, well, 2002 was the year when Austin walked out.
Right. I'm thinking of the of particularly when Rock and Hogan happened. I think that was kind of when Rock was number one and Austin was number two or 1A or whatever.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's just an interesting thing. I'm not saying, you know, Rock was any less of something. WWE was in a really unique time in history when they had two number one guys.
Yeah.
They had Rock and they had Austin. And that's, you know, we look back on it now and, you know, at the time it was just cool. Let's watch some wrestling. But it was a really special period of time where there were two number one stars, not, you know, almost like Hogan and Randy Savage. But I would say Savage was always kind of under Hogan.
Right.
Where Rock could have eclipsed Austin and
yeah.
did points.
Right. I agree with that. So we have I noticed that Shane McMahon does not yet have his own music.
Yeah, I noticed that too. It made me sad. I like the Shane McMahon music.
I'm not sure I'd go that far, but he comes up with No Chance in Hell, but he still does the Shane dance pretty much in the ring.
Yeah. And that, I mean, if I gave star ratings for matches, the Shane McMahon dance would be a guaranteed bonus star.
Okay. See, I'm not a Shane McMahon guy. So, Shane's pretty much always annoyed me and I guess it's part of, you know, his job at certain points, but yeah, I just can't go with you on that. I'm sorry.
I've enjoyed Shane McMahon. He annoyed me when he first kind of in 1998, when he started commentating on Sunday Night Heat, that he really bothered me there. But as kind of the pesky heel, he charmed me a little bit. And I've always had a soft spot in my heart for him and his ridiculous matches where he falls off of tall things. And pretty much the only time where I didn't like Shane McMahon was leading up to WrestleMania 25 in 2009 and Shane's feud with Randy Orton.
Oh, yeah. I forgot all about that. Yeah, Shane McMahon's very slow punches.
Yeah. Yeah. Punches that didn't touch Orton's face, but man, he sold those more than I think he's sold anything since.
Yeah. And also, Triple H still has My Time as his music, which, boy, in retrospect, I mean, not that it's not obvious, but the Motorhead theme is so much better than My Time.
It really is. And it's, I enjoy My Time as a guilty pleasure, just almost the same way I enjoy Shane McMahon.
Sure.
About the My Time theme that, I don't know, it could be the terrible lyrics. It could be, you know, like the part of it that's like the marks, the suits, McMahon. I don't know what it is, but, and it could be just that the guy from the DX that sang the DX theme thought, I've got another hit on my hands. Also, I liked Triple H's lighting more when he had My Time than I like his lighting for the, Motorhead theme.
Okay. Well, what about it? Just
there was a cool element where it still had the same kind of flashing everywhere, but rhythmically I felt like it works better with the My Time theme and the kind of dun da da dun dun da da dun thing that had going on.
Gotcha. All right. I put in my notes here that Steph was the women's champ. And I would put that she was not women's champ much longer, but that's actually not true. She had only recently become women's champ, and then she would hold it until August 21st in Lafayette, Louisiana, when she lost to Lita. So she was champion for quite a long time.
Yeah, that's probably one of the longer reigns, because she won it on the last SmackDown before WrestleMania 2000.
Okay, that sounds right.
Yeah, I think like the final thing of the show was Stephanie as your woman's champion. Now watch WrestleMania to see if Triple H retains his title, which it would be so interesting if they were able to build a woman up to do that now. Like, Beth Phoenix is woman's champion. Order that pay-per-view.
Yeah. Maybe you could have done that with AJ at her peak, or maybe she's still there. I haven't been watching much recently, so I know she's all over the shows. I know that she's the GM, but I haven't really gotten to the point where I get how effective that is going.
I'm enjoying it. A lot of other people aren't, but I tend, you know, like, I enjoy Shane McMahon, and Triple H is my time entrancing. So I'm always the best judge of what's good. I just know what's good to me.
Yes. Well, that's fair. That's all we can really say. Vince is also out there, and he gets the microphone. He directs everyone's attention to the fine print in the program that they received that says card subject to change, and says that Steve Austin will not be there. And then Jim Ross wonders, of course, well, how would he know that? Because, you know, he's not really in touch with Austin these days. It's not like they're buddies or anything. So how would he have any idea where Steve Austin was? Which is a good question.
Yeah, it really is. And the program he used is just a copy of WWF Magazine that they shoved a paper insert into with the evening's card on it.
Okay.
A note that said card subject to change. Like, that's actually what they sold in shows at the time, and they charged $10 for the magazine, basically.
Yeah, because I remember at the time that I basically had a similar thing as a kid when I went to the house shows, but they were, it wasn't WWF magazine, it was like a specific program, or a specific publication. I forget what it was called, but it wasn't WWF Magazine. It was like a little bit different, but they also shoved that piece of paper in there. So it was kind of a similar thing.
Yeah. I was at SummerSlam this past Sunday, and they sent nice glossy programs that you can buy now with pictures of all the wrestlers that I feel like if I were 10 would be really cool, but not so much now.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but they were fun. Those programs, I remember. I remember liking them at the time. I didn't really have so much of an issue with, being ripped off, because I didn't really have any concept of money when I was 7 years old. And The Rock, his entrance happens, and people are pretty into The Rock, I noticed.
Yeah, people like that guy.
Yeah, yeah, they're very loud and boisterous and cheering for him.
Right up until the glass doesn't break right then. They were super interested in cheering for him.
Yes, yeah. And so he stands on the second rope, and then we have Triple H sort of staring at him. They have like kind of a cool visual stare down that you don't normally see, with Rock doing his pose in second rope and Triple H kind of standing there defiant, which I thought was cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we have Jim Ross at this point saying that Triple H is as good as I've ever seen, meaning as good of a champion as he's ever seen, which maybe a little bit of a stretch, but he certainly had a good run at this point. There's no question that Triple H in 2000 had a great run, both on pay-per-view, and I think even more than that, really, his television matches stood out. Like, there was a famous one where he wrestled Taka Michinoku, and they had a very there was even a near fall during that match off, I believe, a moonsault, in which the crowd thought that there was a chance of Taka Michinoku becoming WWF champion. And there's also one against Rikishi that was really good. And then just before this, there was that classic Jericho match.
Yeah, and all of those worked. Like, Triple H was working so hard at this time. And it's funny, because if you look at his heel run from when he first turned after WrestleMania 15, really up until the moment where he marries Stephanie, Triple H's run is awkward. Like, there's nothing. You know, the crowd's not getting behind him. He, you know, beats Mick Foley for the title the night after SummerSlam 1999, and Triple H just isn't connecting for some reason. The heel act seems put on. He can't go back to the DX babyface act. He's in this odd middle zone where it's just like there something needs to happen here. Something needs to click. And this is kind of around when they put DX back together as a heel faction as well. And what finally clicks is the Stephanie McMahon angle and just how sleazy that is and how sleazy she turns out to be as, you know, his valet and manager type thing. And along with that, the next month you get Triple H versus Mick Foley or Triple H versus Cactus Jack at the Royal Rumble, where Triple H really starts to catch on as a heel and starts this dynamic and really exciting and fun run of great matches on top. And these TV matches were all part of that as well, that it's just Triple H was the workhorse champion. He was the guy that was really getting elevated in the absence of Steve Austin. And while he was before Austin took off, with Austin gone, there was that room at the top for Triple H to be the top.
Yeah, he was the focus of the show, which I think was really, you know, and with Austin being around, he may not have had that same spotlight, you know, just because Austin was such an omnipresent guy whenever he was on there that, you know, there may not have been as much room to do as much with Triple H, even if you were pushing him. So in one way, Austin's absence was probably very helpful for him in that respect.
And I think it was helpful that Rock wasn't, you know, whether it was the way he was written or whatever it was, Rock wasn't as in the spotlight as Austin often was all the time. Rock kind of seemed, you know, able to take a backseat occasionally and let the heel get that monster heat that Triple H was getting at this point, rather than being always there. And I don't mean to say Austin was selfish or anything at all in this. It's just an observation that Rock was more, you know, Triple H was able to get over with Rock as his opposition more than he was with Austin as his opposition.
Yeah, I agree with that. And although Austin and Triple H would do some great stuff later into 2001, yeah, the stuff they did like in 99 for whatever reason just wasn't that effective.
Yeah, it was kind of awkward.
Yeah. I do think that Jerry Lawler here, with his over-the-top defense of the McMahons and whatever they do here, is pretty funny. And then JR being very cranky and telling Lawler that he just should go directly kiss Vince's ass, I think also there was some good comedy between the two there.
Yeah, I loved Jim Ross just like as the match is starting going, how can Shane be objective? Like, just so upset and passionate about, well, that's not fair. Shane McMahon's not going to be an objective referee. And, you know, basically, really, Ross was such a fun commentator during this time because he wasn't afraid to let himself get that passionate about things. And while Michael Cole will overtly cheer on a heel almost the way that Jerry Lawler is doing here, sometimes now today, Michael Cole or Jerry Lawler isn't willing to really get upset and really get riled up in favor of the lead babyface or the top guy.
Sure. Yeah, it just isn't quite the same dynamic as it was. And, you know, obviously it's been a decade since Lawler, well, but 12 years since this for Lawler, and Lawler obviously seems to kind of like the later Bobby Heenan, where it just didn't seem like he was super into it anymore.
Yeah, you're not watching Raw right now, but last night on Raw, when talking about the new WWE app, there was a great moment where Michael Cole goes, yeah, with this app now, Jerry, you could actually do some homework.
Well,
and that was it. But it was just like this, you know, this little mention where I think a lot of insider fans know, oh, yeah, Jerry Lawler doesn't really do his homework for matches. He shows up at the arena, says what they tell him to, and still is at least decent commentator.
Right, right. Well, you know, all that experience will. Although I know there's a lot of people who disagree with that, but yeah, obviously, you know, regardless of his strengths and or weaknesses as a commentator, I do love me some Jerry Lawler.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I enjoy Lawler quite a bit.
Yeah. So as you mentioned, we have the We Want Austin chance to begin. I do like the JR has a commentary line in which he knows for certain, as a matter of fact, without a doubt, that Steve Austin would not sell out to Vince McMahon.
Yeah.
Which, of course, is funny given what will happen in 11 months from now.
Oh,
in
yeah.
which Steve Austin sells out to Vince McMahon. Just funny in hindsight, of course.
Yeah, it's you know, and no one was more shocked and appalled at Steve Austin for doing that than Jim Ross.
No, so. No.
Yeah.
And so we begin the match with they get to the middle of the ring. They trade punches. Triple H is able to get a knee lift. He punches him into the corner, but Rock fights out of that with his own punches. He tries to do the old punch twice and then the big spit punch, but that is cut off. Rock nails him a few times, but then Triple H finally knocks him down with a reverse elbow Rock gets him with the reverse elbow. Then Triple H ducks a clothesline, tries the pedigree, but then Rock backdrops. Finally, Shane gets in Rock's way as Rock is beating up on the corner, and then Triple H is able to come out of it with a reverse neckbreaker.
Yeah, a fun starting sequence. I feel like the crowd was really with them.
Oh, they were. This was a very, very rabid crowd.
Yeah, and that, you know, again, that kind of goes to the point of, well, you know, the Vince got them riled up with the card subject to change stuff and got them even more passionate about seeing Steve Austin. And even with all of that, they still then turned their attention to the match and really got into it and really bought into Rock's moment, which, again, it's another argument for delayed gratification. You don't go with this at WrestleMania. You do it at Backlash, and you get even more of a passionate crowd here.
Yeah, yeah. And they're in D.C., Washington, D.C., by the way, for the record. These D.C. fans are getting into it for sure. Rock is able to get a back suplex, but then is tossed out over the ropes and then thrown into the steps, and his face is dropped on the announce table. Now, JR oddly has a complaint here in that what Triple H is doing is not legal. However, this is the Attitude Era, and things like this were pretty much happening all the time, and certainly in main event matches.
Yeah, and I feel like Ross's complaint, it's, hey, the match wasn't made no disqualification and no count out. But especially with a special referee, I think even today with special referees, you tend to expect there to be a little more leniency. But, you know, even then, and when your special referee favors one guy the way Shane McMahon obviously did, that's just what you're going to get.
Sure, sure. Rock is able to duck several Triple H clotheslines, but Triple H gets the high knee. Which gets two. Ross complains is a fast count from Shane. Triple H gets a vertical suplex, and we cut to Steph on one side and Vince on the other. Reaction shots of them of Steph beaming and then Vince sort of nodding in approval. So they're very happy what's going on here. Triple H gets a knee drop for two. And then another immediate cover for two. Shane noticeably counting fast here. Rock tries to fight back, but Triple H gets a sleeper. Then sort of that turns into a reverse chin lock. Rock goes down to the mat, and they're down here for a decent amount of time. Ross at this point refers to internet speculation because, of course, Steve Austin has yet to show up, that Austin would screw The Rock. Not literally, of course, but he would betray The Rock, I should say.
Internet fan fiction where Austin.
Right.
Which would then be published as, you know, 50 Shades of Attitude and become.
Exactly.
God help us all. Yeah, I thought that the internet speculation thing was funny. Jim Ross is like, I read it. I think I have internet at my house at this time. So right. I'm trying to remember, and I'm pretty sure it was another year before we joined the World Wide Webiverse at the Pruitt household.
Ah, I see.
Yeah, you mentioned it going back a little bit in the match, the delayed vertical suplex there. For some reason, something about that suplex just struck me as awesome. Like, Triple H, I guess it's just the way he kind of fell back with Rock on it.
Mm-hmm.
I looked at it and was just like, that's a really nice suplex. Nice work, Hunter.
There you go. Good job. Way to work.
Yeah, I want to high-five him.
Yeah, yeah.
If I ever see him, I'm going to be like, that suplex you gave Rock in 2000. That's the defining move of your career. Let's
yeah.
do that.
And one of the 9,000 matches in which he wrestled Rock that year.
Probably one of the 20,000 times he suplexed Rock that year.
Yes, yes. So meanwhile, Vince grabs the Rock, tosses him into the post, and then throws him into the ring. That gets two. We have another Rock ducking several Triple H clotheslines, and then Triple H hitting the high knee. This was not a good match for Rock coming off the ropes, because every single time he tried to do that, then it did not work out well for him. So.
Yeah, the Rock should have avoided bouncing.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, that was earlier in the match. I got a little bit mixed up on where I was. But after the internet speculation that Austin would screw the Rock, we have Triple H trying to use the ropes for a pin, which I always appreciate heels that try to use the ropes. That's that feels like a thing they don't do nearly enough these days, of heels actually, like, within the context of the match, like, cheating and being bad and being wicked, which I feel like they do a lot outside of the ring, but inside the ring, I feel like that's a bit of a lost art.
And I think it's a little touches from heels, like getting out of a submission hold by gouging the eyes. It's raking the back, as fun and silly as back rakes look sometimes. It's,
sure.
You know, it is holding the ropes. That those things don't happen as much. And, you know, there's some classic moments that it's kind of cheap heat that you can get from the crowd. And why not go for it?
Yeah, yeah. It's better. It seems like it's cheap heat that always works. I mean, it's cheap, but it's still, like, within the you know, context of a match, it works. It's not like it's, you know, I don't know. It feels like more valid than insulting the local sports team or things that, you know, you that are normally associated with cheap heat. So.
Yeah, it's more valid because it's actually trying to win the match. It's not just, well, I'm going to talk down about your sports team because I don't like them.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, exactly. So now one thing I wonder here, and I'm applying logic, which I should not do. There's two things. One, what if when Austin comes in, Rock has already been beaten and he's too late? But two, why doesn't Shane just decide, like, while Triple H is in this chin lock, hey, the Rock, you know, he gave up. Let's ring the bell. You know, I feel like he could have just done, you know, a Montreal screw job type thing, and they would have all been done way earlier.
Yeah, they would have been having a beer by the time Austin apparently got to the arena. Just
yeah.
like, you were late, man. Sorry.
Yeah.
Those are valid points. That
needs to happen sometime in wrestling where, like, they're, like, you know, the good guy, you know, plans to make his dramatic entrance, or the bad guy, or whatever. Like, they need to, like, after the match is over, they need to, like, run out and then realize that they were, like, too late. That, like, their plan was, like, you know, way too late. I think that just needs to happen at some point.
Yeah, maybe, like, even a little backstage promo. Dude, I was totally planning to run in.
Yeah.
But I finished my game of Madden backstage. I'm talking about the playoffs. I'm not going to pause that ish.
Right. Exactly. You know, you're on a run. You don't want to just, you know, stand there and take a break. You lose the momentum, you know?
You come back, maybe you're a little sweaty, or maybe you don't remember the controls so well, you throw a pick six, boom, your whole season's ruined.
Exactly. This is the playoffs.
Yeah, you don't want that. You've got to, you need to keep in there. So
yeah.
I'm going to assume that Austin was playing Madden 2000 backstage.
Which makes total sense.
Yeah.
Actually, more likely he was playing some kind of hunting game.
Probably. Given how he was dressed.
Right. So, Jim Ross points out that he is not a corporate ass kisser like you are to Jerry Lawler. He's being a little, even perhaps to the point of being mean to Jerry Lawler here.
Yeah, I feel like that was one of the Ross and JR dynamics, is there were moments where it was just like, wow, Ross, you know, almost, because Ross was almost that verbal representation of Steve Austin when he wasn't there, and Steve Austin wasn't a nice person.
Right.
I feel like Ross got that opportunity to just be a jerk sometimes and be like, well, I don't kiss all the ass like you do.
Exactly. Yeah, And he, you know, everyone of course loves Jim Ross, so obviously he made it work for him.
Yeah. Also,
go ahead.
Jim Ross wasn't and isn't that nice.
Yeah. Like,
especially in this period when he was head of talent relations, there a lot of people said, great commentator, kind of a jerk, because he was Vince's hatchet man, if you will.
True, true.
He carries his hatchet.
Yeah, which you need someone to carry your hat. You don't want to carry your own hatchet.
Well, if you're a billionaire like Vince McMahon, why even touch your own hatchet? Just put your name on it and give it to someone else.
Exactly. So, so Rock, he fights out, runs into the Triple H punch, and then this is the point in which I made note of the coming off the ropes not working well. That gets two. I like that Triple H is doing a little bit of bad mouthing of Rock in the corner. Like, you know, how do you like this, buddy? You know, probably doing a better bad mouth than I just did there. I didn't write down exactly what he said, but you know, he's definitely, you know, he's definitely working the verbal chops, so to speak.
Yeah.
Instead of the crotch chops.
I think "how do you like this, buddy" is a perfectly fine bad mouth.
Okay. Like, thank you.
I'm about to beat you, sir.
Yeah. What do you think of that? What do you think of those apples? he tries to do the turnbuckle 10 punches thing, Triple H does, but that doesn't really work for heels so well. And Rock ends up dropping Triple H's face onto the turnbuckle. And then we have Rock with a big flurry of punches. His Irish whip is reversed, and they double clothesline each other. So that one at least was more neutral on Rock's behalf, not necessarily against him.
Yeah, but it didn't turn out so well for him
in no.
a few moments anyways. But I feel like the double clothesline became one of those main event cliches in WWF around this time. It
yeah.
For just in my head, like, we don't see near as many double clotheslines now as we did then. And it's something, I think Bret Hart in his book said he came up with the double clothesline. Don't know if that's true, but, you know, Bret Hart would never exaggerate or hold a grudge. Bret said he came up with the double clothesline, and it's just something I think that's left over from Bret Hart's run on top, where a bunch of dudes were like, yeah, let's double clothesline. It'll get the crowd into it.
Yeah, I feel like I've seen double clothesline way before Bret. Maybe he, you know, that's a weird thing for Bret to say. But then again, I can't remember like the exact origin of it, so you never know.
Yeah,
I feel like somebody would have thought of that before you know, late '80s, early '90s, though.
I definitely think they did. I'm not sure. I'm pretty sure Bret said that he came up with the double clothesline spot, though. That's
okay.
I didn't read the book this morning, but.
Right.
Pretty sure that happened.
Okay. I don't remember the book. I don't remember that being in the book, but great book, though. I bet Triple H would have a good book.
I think it would depend on if Triple H was allowed to be Triple H or allowed to be kind of honest in it.
Exactly.
I don't see Triple H writing a book for the same reason that Vince isn't writing one, and that's Triple H is still, or Triple H is kind of the next Vince that'll be running things.
Right. I feel like the only way Vince would ever do a book if like Vince wants like a legacy for himself. I mean, he already has a legacy. Let me put it this way. If he wants like if he wants more respectability, he wants to like explain himself to, not explain himself to his critics, but like, I don't know, explain himself to a neutral party kind of thing. I feel like that's the only way we'd get a Vince book. And it would certainly be like a whitewashing type book, but I feel like that's the only way we'd get a Vince book.
I feel like if Vince McMahon wrote a book, I would swear off going to wrestling websites for a year, because all they would write about, and I write for a wrestling website.
Sure.
But all they would be writing about at that point is, Vince McMahon was so wrong about this in his book, and this is why we're better than him. That's it. Sorry,
yeah.
I have pet peeves involving wrestling websites. It's a...
Sure.
They, basically.
Yeah.
You know.
There are better wrestling websites than others, though. Let's we'll go to that at the end when we do our plugs.
Yeah, we will.
Yeah. So they're both down. Shane does the double count while also trying to revive Triple H at the same time. Now, meanwhile, Rock uses the ropes to climb up, and he is on the side of the ring and where Vince is. And so Vince grabs the belt, comes onto the apron, and nails him in the head, which was very nice and sneaky by Vince.
Yeah, it's nice that Vince went behind the referee's back to do that, considering the referee wouldn't have cared anyways.
Exactly. Triple H crawls over to Rock, but only gets a two. The fans are openly chanting Austin at this point. Rock is able to get up, get a flurry in the corner, finally connects on the spit punch. And definitely when you spit in your hand right before the punch, it is more effective. That's science.
Yeah, the velocity is greater because you're traveling with liquid.
Exactly, yes. He does a clothesline off the corner. He does the whip, but then sends Triple H into the other corner, and Triple H does his flippy thing over the ropes onto the floor, which he apparently hurts his shoulder. Rock does a clothesline on the outside, then drops Triple H onto the table. Back in, Triple H gets a face buster, and both Lawler and Ross make note of Triple H hurting his shoulder. And you can see sort of later on in the match, he definitely has his left arm to his side, and he's punching only with his right arm, or really doing things only with his right arm.
Yeah, and I wonder, I didn't look it up in any, catalogs of things, but I wonder if this was a little bit of a legitimate shoulder injury where Triple H was, needed a little bit of time off to heal, because I believe the next night on Raw, they went with a Rock versus Shane McMahon cage match and not a Rock versus Triple H rematch or anything like that.
Yeah. Well, they were doing the Rock Triple H on pay-per-view the next month anyway, but yeah, it seemed like a legitimate thing, cuz didn't really play at all into the story of the match.
Yeah, it's not like the shoulder really, it's not like Rock tried to put him in the crossface or anything like that. The shoulder never came into play.
Exactly. So, Rock is able to get a DDT, but Shane refuses to count. Rock then punches Shane out, but that allows Triple H to clothesline him over the ropes from behind. Then Rock is sent shoulder first into the steps. Then Hunter clears the table, gets a flurry of punches, then he sets up the pedigree. However, Rock gets a low blow and sets up the Rock Bottom. Shane tries to stop, but then it ends up as Rock grabbing Shane as well behind Hunter and then doing a double Rock Bottom with Shane on the bottom. We have nice reaction shots from Steph, who is shocked. Vince gets his gulp in, and then there is a nice visual of the three bodies all like strewn across this broken table. And it's kind of a cool, even if, it's sort of the idea that he could do the Rock Bottom to two of these guys is a little silly, but that was fun.
Yeah, I thought it was a really fun spot. I love the Vince McMahon gulp. That's a fun one to watch, because he got it into like every match that he was at ringside for in this era. And knocking out Shane McMahon was obviously a key part of this match. I just wonder, at that point, why Vince I forget how the power structure worked, but I think Vince had power to make rulings on matches too. So I kind of wonder why Vince didn't ring the bell and just have Rock disqualified for putting his hands on an official that way.
There you go.
Also, do you know when they started clearing tables for the big table spots?
I feel like it was about at this point, maybe even into like 99, because I remember that was weird when they would just like actively start grabbing, clearing the monitors and clearing everything into the table. I don't feel like they definitely didn't do that. Like, one very memorable one, I know they didn't do it, was 96, the Shawn Michaels Diesel match.
Well, that was one of the first, announce table spots.
Yeah. And I feel like they didn't do it necessarily in 97, but they may have started doing it like 98, 99.
I know they didn't do it for WrestleMania 14 when Kane and Undertaker went through the table. That table was fully set up still.
Okay. I want to say
it's the French announce table, but I'm just kind of curious because that when they now it's not super jarring, but at the time I remember being like, why are you taking the monitors off? Like, why does that make the table have more impact if you take the heavy things out of it?
Yeah. Well, I guess maybe the idea is you don't hurt yourself while putting them through the table because the monitor could fly up and hit you or something, or, you know. But yeah, it does seem weird for them politely to clear the equipment and then do this brutal thing. And yeah, that's always been kind of a bother for me. You know, it's sort of like, okay, it just sort of makes it seem, I don't know, it makes it seem silly.
Yeah.
And not silly in a good way, silly in a bad way.
Mm-hmm.
So then they take some time to recover. The Rock and Triple H end up back in the ring. Vince sneaks in and clubs Rock from behind. Then Vince gets a little cocky and taunts the Rock, so Rock turns around and attacks him. However, this allows Triple H to hit a low blow and then a pedigree. Unfortunately for him, Shane is still out, so Vince calls for a new ref, and my goodness, who should show up but Pat Patterson and Jerry Briscoe, who, by the way, also, I believe, turned around the same time as that DX turn. Like, they sort of came in and were part of this new McMahon-Helmsley regime roughly around the same time that Vince turned, I guess. So sometime in between there.
Well, they were always Vince McMahon's men.
Yeah. Well, no, they were good guys for a little bit, even after Vince turned, maybe. Like, in 99, I feel like they were the good comedy relief for a little while. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but I feel like they were good even after Vince turned bad again for a while.
Was it the year 2000 or the year 1999 when they were in the I'm trying to think of what it was.
2000. It was they were in a lingerie match against each other, I believe, or evening gown match.
I think it was King of the Ring 2000. They were in an evening gown match together.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think it was around that time that they were the comedy relief. But I have to say, Gerald Briscoe looks remarkably blonde here. Like, his hair is yellow blonde.
You mean Patterson?
Yeah, sorry, Patterson. That'd be awesome if Gerald Briscoe looked blonde. Sorry. Yeah, Pat Patterson was remarkably blonde.
He was remarkably blonde. He was like 1979 blonde.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they double-team The Rock and hold him while Triple H battles him. You can very noticeably notice that Triple H is using just the one arm and the other one is dangling here. One thing, you know, and you've mentioned it before in the Elimination Chamber podcast we did, and of course he's famous for in several instances, Triple H would certainly, if he'd get hurt in a match, he would certainly power through it and get what he needed to done. That was certainly a remarkable thing that maybe he doesn't get quite enough credit for.
Yeah, and you know, there was the trachea injury in that Elimination Chamber, the apparent shoulder injury in this one, and then the most famous thing that Triple H has powered through was tearing his quad in the year 2001 in the tag match.
Yeah, with Benoit and Jericho when he and Austin were a team. So,
and still telling Jericho in that match, Jericho says this in a second book, but Jericho going, I don't need to put that hold on you. I don't need to put you in the walls or whatever. And Triple H going, no, it's the match. You do the match, which is just extreme to me because I know if I were in that boat, I'd be like, yeah, let's do something different for your attacking my league. How's that?
Yeah, that's a good idea. So, Vince grabs a chair, nails Rock in the head. Triple H picks up the Rock for the pedigree instead of going for the pin, which is sort of an odd decision. But, and then the glass shatters and Stone Cold's music comes out. Stone Cold's music hits and then he comes out. Triple H runs into Austin's boot, gets hit in the back with a chair, then chair shot in the head to Briscoe, chair shot in the head to Patterson, then a chair shot in the head to Shane, and then one to Vince, who also gets the extra added bad mouth, as Austin was known to do. Triple H, by then recovered a bit, tries to attack with a chair, but Austin nails him with his first. And then, as Austin goes to leave after the carnage he has ensued, we have Linda, who walks by with Earl Hebner, who had been fired in just a few weeks before in the famous Jericho match, which we can talk a little bit about after we're done with this. Linda is confronted by Stephanie, and she immediately pushes Stephanie down. Triple H grabs a chair, but then runs into the Rock Spinebuster. The Rock does the People's Elbow, covers him. Earl slides in, and then Earl does his trademark slow count. That is all pretty much he always does whenever he is counting a final pin or after he has been injured. He will often do the slow count as well. And most of his matches that are big world title matches, he seems to get bumped. So it's a trademark slow count is my point. He does that. It's a three count. And there is pretty much one of the biggest pops that I recall hearing for the win here.
Well, and you have people like, and you just don't see this at wrestling events that often. The crowd is jumping. Like, they go to a wide shot of the crowd, and the entire crowd seems like they're just a wave of people moving up and down, and it is amazing to see. Did you notice, sorry to go back a little bit, but did you notice Austin, when he went down to badmouth Vince McMahon, the trouble he had getting back up?
I didn't, but that doesn't surprise me, given you know, what he was dealing with, and he did have an extra 20-30 pounds here.
Yeah, he was larger, which apparently you can't do much cardio after neck surgery.
Right.
But he goes down, and as he's getting back up, instead of just kind of shooting up the way you'd expect a professional wrestler to, he actually uses the chair in his other hand, and Austin is in like a flurry of action. And he gets up kind of in slow motion and then returns to the flurry of action. And there were people that said Austin was barely able to do that at this point by this show. Like, he was still, he was a few months removed from surgery, but he was still in the recovery phase.
Yeah.
And the fact that he could walk down the ramp and swing a chair was seen as remarkable. You know, he was still, 4 or 5 months off from returning to the ring. So yes. Austin wasn't in great shape at this point, and that's probably why they structured this the way they did, where he's barely out there, he comes in, swings at the chair, and leaves.
Yeah. Plus, how do you work him in the match when, if he's out there the entire time? I guess you can prevent the McMahon's from getting involved. Like, every time they try to interfere, you could have him get through, but that would require him to do a lot more, obviously. And given that situation, that makes a lot of sense.
And there's the added bonus that him being out there could overshadow Rock, and people would start cheering for Austin, confronting and stopping the McMahon's instead of cheering for Rock wrestling for the WWF Championship.
Yeah, excellent point. I mean, obviously, we've hit on a number of, logic gaps that presented, and that various things in this match have happened. But in a practical matter, yeah, you kind of had – he had to come out in the end, because otherwise it wouldn't – he just couldn't have done it. It wouldn't have been as effective.
Yeah, which is, I'm not trying to – point out a brand new logic gap or anything, or say this is what should have happened. This match came off crazy effectively. Like, yeah. The Austin, Austin coming out when he did, like, from that point to Rock winning the championship, there was just like a sustained roar from that crowd.
Yeah, it was electric, no question about it. I mean, this match wasn't necessarily my cup of tea for the most part. I mean, it was a little busier, a little, bigger. I mean, it was entertaining. It's not like I didn't like it, it's sort of odd that it's not necessarily a match that I feel like has stood the test of time as far as like a real memorable signature win of Rock's career, even though it was his first title win as a good guy, and, was the culmination, but was the his first big win in a pretty big story in a peak time for pro wrestling and for WWE. But still, you know, for this night, for this crowd, it was certainly, you know, emotional and memorable, and it worked very well.
And things like this match not standing the test of time, it's a reason why I cut with wrestling that I like. I'm like, the Attitude Era was cool, but I enjoy the wrestling that we see today more than I enjoy the wrestling from the Attitude Era. Mm-hmm. Just because I feel like so much of the Attitude Era was based on formulas like this match, based on, okay, and we're going to bump the ref here, and we're going to go through the table, and we're going to use all of these tricks. We're going to do the crowd brawl. All of these things have worked, but just were not, you know, you watch them today, and, you know, with the hindsight of knowing, okay, well, and then next month they had this match where the ref got bumped, and this guy ran in, and the McMahons ran in, and then the next month they had this match where the same things happened. It's nice to be able, you know, to watch today, and we don't get as many shenanigans in our matches today.
Yeah, yeah. As you mentioned, the fact that Triple H regains it a month later at Judgment Day, and then Rock ends up winning it back in like a 6-man where he pins Vince, and, you know, it goes on for several more months. It was like, if this had been the end of the story and both guys moved on to something else and they went back to Triple H Rock later, maybe, kind of like if this had been the kind of blow off that you would have had, like, Savage Hogan or Austin Michaels or whatever, where it was like a definitive thing and they didn't really go back to it right away, I think maybe it'd be a little more remembered as like big storyline closure. But really, this was just kind of like the next chapter, you know, in the story, and there was still several more to go, and the ending chapters weren't, you know, as well done. I mean, they were good, you know, they were definitely high points, but they didn't probably have the same emotional catharsis that this had. But given where it was structured in the story, it doesn't have that same lasting thing.
Yeah, I'm interested and a little bit puzzled by the choice to go for the Iron Man match a month later, just because this did feel like the end. This did feel like that major victory. And it's so against the traditional WWE booking philosophy of get the belt on a good guy, let the good guy keep it for a long time, you know, and overcome the champions, beat the monsters, if you will. And this was very much, okay, well, we need to get that belt back on Triple H for the moment. You know, it was, let's set up the chase again.
Right, but the chase didn't last that long either. I mean, in the summer, they went to new opponents pretty much. I mean, they went to you know, Triple H eventually hooked up with Angle. That was more in the fall, but, you know, that was starting off. Triple H feuded with Jericho, Rock feuded with Benoit, and Undertaker was involved. I mean, they got other guys in the mix, and some of them were fresh new guys. But, yeah, it does seem weird in hindsight. Like, I guess they felt like it was so hot they wanted to stretch it 2 or 3 months, which is obviously a very common thing they do today. But oddly, yeah, it does seem odd in retrospect, given this, what this kind of felt like. They didn't really just end it and go on to new things, for at least for a while.
Yeah, I think, you know, you go on to new things for 4 or 5 months and then you come back. And then if they were to come back to it, and even then, okay, well, let's have the Iron Man match at that moment. Well, that works a little bit better than having it that very next month. And historically, the impact of this match, which, if you just watch it in a vacuum and think about on that night, the impact of this match is huge. But historically, the impact of this match is decreased when the title bounced around between them a little bit more before finally ending up on Rock through SummerSlam all the way to No Mercy that year when Kurt Angle beat him for it.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So Rock celebrates for a good while, and then as he ascends the ropes, Austin comes out again. He drives a big truck through, actually. He gets in the ring. The music goes quiet. They look at each other for a bit, and then Austin grabs a couple of beers. They're tossed to him. They share the beer. They both toast the title in a nice moment and take a drink, and Rock's music plays and he stands up, and that's about it. So nice happy celebration. Everyone is cheerful and happy with how things have gone, and that's about it.
Well, the truck he's pulling is towing the exploded DX Express.
Oh, I missed that. Okay, that makes sense, though.
Mm-hmm. That's a really important bus in wrestling history.
it is a great. Is it the most important bus in wrestling history?
You know, there people have talked about Big Show's tour bus and Triple H's tour bus and all that.
Yeah. What about the Lex Express?
Oh, it's true. The Lex Express gives it a run for its money. I think Randy Orton's. One of his wives was attacked or, like, oddly stalked by CM Punk on a tour bus.
Yeah.
But I would say it's between the DX Express and the Lex Express as far as most important bus in wrestling history. And I think looking at historical impact, I have to give it to the DX Express.
Hmm. I'm going to go ahead and go with the Lex Express, but only because of the better rhyme there.
Hmm. That's true. The DX Express is a little, it's a little odd.
Yeah. The Lex Express is just a little smoother, you know, but I'm not saying that you're wrong. Your opinion is valid to me.
Now, if Yokozuna had dropped himself from a crane onto the Lex Express, I would definitely say Lex Express.
Yeah.
And that story would be pretty much 10 times better to me.
Perhaps.
Yeah.
It would have been just about America. It would have also been the destruction of a wonderful bus.
Yeah, a bus that really embodied the hope of America at the time.
It did, yes. Yeah. It's funny how a bus can do that.
It's strange, but I'm not going to question it. 1993 was a weird year, man.
Why would you? Absolutely. But it feels like, and you know, maybe this is just a getting older thing or whatever, but it feels like the difference between 1993 and 2000 is just so much more vast than the difference between 2000 and 2012 in wrestling. Even though I know wrestling's moved away from a lot of these Attitude Era tropes and so on and so forth, and it's, you know, maybe wrestling now is more like wrestling in 1993, but it just feels like the vast difference between those times, not necessarily in terms of like how it feels in a length of time. I just mean the worlds of wrestling themselves and how quickly they evolved.
They evolved quickly. And then I think the evolution stopped. I think a nice way to look at it, at least for me, is in the way they tell stories and just the look of the product. Wrestling looks like it did in 2012. The technology's gotten better, but it's still, you know, the things that were introduced in, you know, around this time, I guess, and going as far back as 1997, well, the arena's always set up the same way now. The, you know, the ring, you know, it always, same color ropes, they changed that. They're, you know, the set's always huge. There's always the big screen. There's always those things that you can count on at a wrestling event now. That in 1993, you didn't get as much of. It was, oh, well, we may have the neon WWF logo or just the tunnel to the back or the circular lighting rig made like the guys can walk through for an entryway. It wasn't always the big screen and all of that. And I think the evolving visual presentation ended and they kind of reached the pinnacle of what they could do. And wrestling had to change the way that they told stories with the Monday Night Wars and start saying, okay, well, we need to accelerate the pace or we're going to lose people's interest. And they ended up permanently having to do that in order to maintain at least a fraction of the momentum that they had in the late 90s and early 2000s.
Mm-hmm. Also, I think the difference possibly is that the roster, I mean, Triple H and Rock are still heavily involved in WWE today, even if they aren't regular characters. Whereas nobody, except maybe your odd Billy Gunn or Bob Holly from 93, was around in 2000.
That's true. And that's a very stark kind of thing. But you look, and a lot of people from 1993 were still wrestling in 2000 or, you know, still around wrestling. They just weren't with the WWF at the time.
That's true. Yes. Yes.
With competition, maybe we'd be seeing, well, not Rock and Triple H most likely, but, you know, with real competition, maybe you'd be seeing more wrestlers from this era showing up on the other show.
Yeah.
which kind of happens on Impact anyways.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe less of it in the last couple years, but that's certainly something Impact's been known for a long time. So,
yeah.
All right. Well, yeah, I mean, I think we're pretty much in agreement where this is a fun but oddly not historically important. I mean, historically important, but not really. Like, we had a question from Butch Rosser on whether we consider this the signature win of Rock's career. And I guess, you know, really we don't, because, I mean, it is to a certain extent, but it just is lacks the historical significance because of the things we talked about.
Yeah. What do you consider to be the signature win of Rock's career then, if you had to pick one?
Well, I mean, signature match, I think even though they weren't wins, I mean, I think the signature matches are the WrestleMania of next year against Austin, the Hogan match, which of course it was a win. Mm-hmm. I think those are the two that I think of right away. Also was not another one that was not a win. The ladder match with Triple H, one of Rock and Triple H's many pay-per-view matches. I believe you counted those, in fact. But I feel like that match really elevated him to a new view as far as fans. I mean, he was clearly becoming a hot character in 98, was Intercontinental Champion and had a great run with that, and was somebody who people really saw something in, but I think it was that match that really brought him in another level in fans' eyes and then led to him, you know, getting the bigger push and becoming champion even sooner than people thought.
Yeah, I think there was something about that 1998 match that definitely sticks out as Rock, you know, finally, you know, kind of breaking out. And that was, I feel like that 98 Triple H feud was a breakout feud for The Rock and kind of a breakout feud for Triple H too, where he wasn't carrying Shawn Michaels' old grudges. He wasn't the secondary guy, but it showed it was a moment where Triple H showed that he could be the guy. It just took him a while to get the formula for Triple H as the guy correct after that. By the way, before this encounter, I didn't count the ones afterwards, but before this match, they were in pay-per-view matches with each other in one way or another 9 times. And that's excluding Royal Rumbles. But 9 times Rock and Triple H were in the same pay-per-view match together. From the first one was in February of 1997 to April of 2000.
Yeah, and then they had at least 3 more in 2000.
Yeah.
And I don't think they've had many since then, but yeah, they certainly had. That's a lot. That's amazing. Actually, in 3 years to have 12 matches against each other.
Yeah, Triple H was hurt in 2001. He was Rock. Then started. You know, he left in 2001 to film his movie as well, and then kind of the sporadic Rock appearances started where he would bail to make a movie, come back, wrestle a couple programs, bail to make a movie, come back, leave for 7 years, come back, fight John Cena.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure, the last one I'm pretty certain is SummerSlam 2000.
I think they were in the six-pack challenge. No, wait, that was Unforgiven 99.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to say that was the last one. I think you're correct, because Rock never had a feud with the two-man power trip. The two-man power trip formed beating up The Rock the night after WrestleMania 17
mm-hmm.
in a steel cage, but that was that's all I can think of on that one. Going back to the defining match of Rock's career question, I would say as far as a big win on the big stage and showing that he is still the man, I almost, and it's very, you know, it's The Rock's latest run, I think you also have to look at WrestleMania 28 as the defining matches of Rock's career. Rock versus Cena, definitely probably the biggest payday of Rock's career. And so the defining match for Rock's bank account would be WrestleMania 28. But I think it's a match that was kind of solely promoted on Rock is back in singles action and he wants to beat this guy up. And there was so much going on around the time that Rock was on top, and there was so much, just everything in the promotion was kind of, you're focused on 4 things in this feud and 4 things in that feud, and there wasn't a singular focus, that this time it was singularly, this is The Rock, this is his big moment.
Yeah, absolutely. It'll be interesting to see how, 10 years from now, how that Rock Cena match is looked at as far as, well, yeah, that whole feud in general, but yeah, as far as where that stands as far as for his legacy, for people think of him as a wrestler, as far as his performances go. But yeah, it's interesting the ones that that stand out for him. And this is certainly a good one, but yeah. Anything else you can think of as far as relating to this? I guess we didn't really talk about the Jericho matches too much.
Yeah, I think although it's not a pay-per-view main event and it doesn't directly play into this, it plays into where Triple H was before this match and where Triple H goes after this match as far as the feud with Jericho, because that match kicked off the Jericho feud, and that feud would kind of come to a boiling point at a Fully Loaded 2000, where they'd have a last man standing match against each other, and it would kind of continue into 2002, where Triple H and Jericho main evented WrestleMania that year, even though they shouldn't have. So it's just an interesting match to look at and an angle to look at, where Chris Jericho seemingly pinned Triple H and won the title, but then Earl Hebner was threatened by Triple H and forced to throw the match out and fired by Triple H for even counting the three.
Yeah, and I think the idea there is also that Earl had maybe done a bit of a fast count on the count for Triple H, so he sort
He
of
did.
acknowledges that and is moved by his own conscience to a certain extent to reverse the decision as well. And yeah, I mean, and Earl kind of was I forget exactly how that started, but basically he and Triple H had been at odds sort of throughout most of early 2000, and part of this is the fact that the whole thing is that when Triple H takes Vince out, he takes control of the power in the company as well. So not only is he the champion, but he's also in charge of the company. In fact, he's really in charge of the company before he wins the title, because he doesn't win it until the first Raw of 2000. I mean, just a couple of weeks before he's champion. But certainly, the idea is that he's using the clout that he has behind the scenes to help him in his in-ring career, which is a fun little life imitates, or art imitates the stereotypes of life kind of thing, and ones that would be even more future stereotypes in the future.
Yeah, I always find that stereotype kind of funny, because it's here where Triple H kind of solidifies his place as a top star. And yeah, in 2002 and 2003, famously, he did use his power to be, to be on top for longer. But I don't think it's as bad as everyone tends to think it is. Maybe I'm more of a Triple H apologist for some reason, but I just, all of the, of course, Triple H gets the main event against Brock Lesnar, and of course, Triple H gets those matches with Undertaker. I think the Triple H character was strong enough, even at this point, that if he's still around years later the way he is, he's having those matches on top. It's not being married to the boss's daughter that does that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that's it. It obviously changes the just what he's going to get, because he has that position, he has that authority. But it's not like it's not like an Eric Watts situation, or it's not like he doesn't have the talent to back that up. I mean, maybe he's been put in more advantageous situations because of that, and I'm going to go ahead and say that he has. But he's delivered plenty of times too, even though there have been periods of his career where he's bored the hell out of me as well. So, it's a complicated legacy, but it's not like, but he's also there because, like, people are into Triple H. I mean, whatever you want to say about his ability or whatever, people are into him and invested in him, and he's been a success. So that's probably the larger reason for anything.
Yeah, it's crazy. Like I mentioned before, last Sunday was SummerSlam, and I was at Staples Center for the event. And people, most of my wrestling correspondence is with online fans, and it was crazy to me how many people were into Triple H and were just like, "Man, Triple H is great. I really hope he gets the best of Brock Lesnar," leading up to that match, because everything everyone was saying online was, well, Lesnar better win this match, and he's ruined, and the whole wrestling is ruined if Brock Lesnar doesn't beat Triple H, and I know Triple H is going to use his power to beat Brock Lesnar and prove that he's better. And I'm like, guys, A, you know Triple H has a legit financial investment in this company. B, you sound crazy. Like, you sound legitimately crazy online when you're just like, ah, Triple H is the worst. I wish he would die. I doubt you do. I really do.
Yeah. Hopefully you don't.
Yeah, that I feel sorry for you if you do. I don't hope anyone in wrestling dies. We've had a little too much of that. We don't need that as wrestling fans. Let's keep everyone alive and just slightly less than hating each other.
Yeah. You know, you can, you know, obviously, you know, you can like who you like and don't like who you don't like, but there's no need to be a dick about it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think everyone, could you just change the name of the podcast to There's No Need to Be a Dick About It?
I'll think about that.
Subtitle. Let's go with subtitle.
Okay. Retrospective. There's no need to be a dick about it. I like it.
Yeah, I'd be into that.
All right, well, we'll put that in business cards. All right, Will, of course, you are with ProWrestling.net.
Yeah.
You should tell people a little bit about ProWrestling.net if they don't know.
Yeah, it's a wrestling news site. It's ran by Jason Powell, one of the kind of most connected guys in wrestling news, and it's very we're not a site that's copying and pasting from other sites. We have legitimate sources. We post legitimate stories. It's not your, you know, standard dirt sheet, if you will. Even stories that other sites report that we don't have, we don't run, unless it's like, hey, here's a SmackDown spoiler where this guy won a title. Then we may put it up and link and credit that site, but we're not running, you know, the rumor from them is this, because if we can't verify it, we're not going to run it. So there's that. As far as my work on the site, I review Impact, review Raw on a weekly basis. I'm also starting a new blog series very soon about Aristotle's Poetics, the earliest work of dramatic criticism and professional wrestling. I have an MFA in drama. I love theater and all of it, and I firmly believe that if wrestling is theater more than it's sport, more than anything else, I believe that wrestling is a form of theater, and I'm excited to analyze wrestling as compared to the earliest work of dramatic criticism. And already as I'm researching and outlining this, I'm finding things that make me appreciate wrestling more and more as a form of drama. So that's kind of some exciting things that are coming from me on ProWrestling.net. If you want to check it out, head over to the website. We do an all-access podcast that you can check out. We have a member section too if you're into paying for your wrestling news. It's a great place to go. And we also have an app for Android, iPhones, pretty much any app store you want to go to. ProWrestling.net is the name of the app, and it's a great place to stay updated on everything that runs on the site.
And people can follow you on Twitter?
Yeah, at It's Will Time on Twitter, where I talk a lot about theater, wrestling, and how adorable my puppy is.
Very good. Well, and of course, you can check out all of our podcasts at WrestleSpective.com. And follow me on Twitter at WrestleSpective and on Facebook at WrestleSpective. I'm posting a lot of old matches and various things. Sometimes they go along with the podcast. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes just random fun stuff. So check out those venues. And also be sure to leave a comment on or leave us a small review and a rating on iTunes. Those are very effective at spreading the word of WrestleSpective, which if you're listening to this and like it, I'm sure you would like to do. And I would certainly like you to do. So hopefully you're willing to do that. And thanks, everyone, again, for checking us out. And we'll be back again soon.